Welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast, presented by Orion Advisor Solutions and hosted by Dr. Daniel Crosby, Orion's Chief Behavioral Officer and New York Times best-selling author.
Today's investors expect more than a transaction. They want a relationship. Show how your firm merges EQ and IQ with Orion's BFI 20, a new shareable assessment developed by Dr. Daniel Crosby that provides you with emotional and attitudinal insights into clients to facilitate more meaningful investing conversations from day one. Get started today at orion.com/BFI20.
Hello and welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby. I'm joined today by the most likable guy in wealth tech, Brian McLaughlin.
Aw. You make me blush here. Nobody can see it.
The most likable guy in wealth tech, founder of Redtail, yep. President at Orion Advisor Solutions. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Man, it's great to be here.
Great to see you.
Orion Ascent.
Oh my gosh. It's nuts, isn't it? Yeah. It's just amazing. We just walked in and taking a look around at just the scale of everything. I mean, 1,800 people are going to be here rolling through the halls this afternoon, and super excited for this.
Yeah, no, it's going to be huge. So we are going to take a different journey today. I could have asked you about the future of wealth tech. You're a coder's coder. We could have talked about any of those things, but I wanted to go mythological on the people today. I wanted to use Joseph Campbell's hero's journey to talk about your journey as an entrepreneur. And we're going to take the folks through five or six stages of Joseph Campbell's monomyth, right? So this is sort of the foundational philosophy for stuff like Star Wars and, you know, parts of the Bible and Harry Potter and things like this. But you have been on an awesome journey. I've been watching you for a long time. And I think you have a lot to tell folks who want to take their own entrepreneurial journey. So I thought we'd take it a little bit different today.
Let's do it. I love that topic. That's a fantastic idea. And yeah, it's been a bit of a journey. So yeah, let's share what I can share.
Yeah, well, you and I are both big nerds. We're both big nerds. And so I thought the monomyth would be the right move. So the first step, Brian, in the monomyth is the call to adventure, right? So this is when the hero feels the call from the universe to step out into the void. What called you to start Redtail, and what was going on at that time, and how did you take the leap?
Oh, wow. So great question. So that's, I mean, without, I won't do the whole history of Redtail. I feel like everybody's already heard that a million times. You can find it on other podcasts. Let's share something different here. Fundamentally, what it was solving my own problem. It wasn't actually solving a problem for others. It was solving my own job. And so if you've heard the story of Redtail, where I started with an OSJ, and you know, I was a grunt, and then I became an IT grunt. And you know, I was very, very fortunate to get into IT, and I really took to it real easily. What was interesting was every night back in, this is late 90s, I'm synchronizing data from advisors across the country so that the business owners could make reports. They could understand what the business looked like. So tried doing that a couple hundred times a night. And, you know, this is back, you want to nerd out, ISDN lines. I was like the first guy in that Sacramento area who had an ISDN line in their apartment so I could do this work at night. And it was so frustrating. So I'm like, guys, we got to get a better solution. It's not scalable. We're never going to be able to get out of this. You got another option. They said, yeah, let's go, you know, because of software. So we shopped some software, couldn't find anything we loved. And I said, well, guys, give me a chance. Give me a week. I can build something. I'll build a prototype of some idea of maybe it's solved my problems. So I, 7 days later, and maybe a little extra, and we had the first version of Redtail, but we didn't call it Redtail. We called it Our Business Online. It was only for the OSJ, and it's only to solve my job, make my life easier.
And wow.
Isn't that funny?
That is. So is that, you know, when you think about entrepreneurs sort of writ large, do you think that's the way that the call comes, is just trying to solve a practical problem in someone's life usually?
You know, I'm just a firm believer that you need to find your passion, what you love doing, and then figure out how to make money doing it. I love computers. I love programming. I love the challenge of it. To me, it's like my creative outlet. Mm-hmm. You know, some people paint, some people do music and all this other stuff, and they become just so deeply ingrained in it. For me, it was computers.
Yeah.
When I was about 16, my mom, I was raised by a single mom. She scrapped the money together to get me a computer. And yeah, we didn't live well off of it or anything like that. We, you know, we did okay, but didn't really have any money. So she scrapped together all this money, had somebody build the computer for us, for me. And I had a modem and the whole thing. And I just latched on. Like, to me, it was like, oh, just felt like normal.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd read the books, and I'd just get going on it, and I just couldn't stop it. I just love that creative outlet. I can build anything I want.
Yeah. So looking for those practical problems, following that passion, way to go for your mom. What a story.
Right?
That's so awesome.
Yeah, she's awesome. So, yeah, so it just naturally kind of fit. I mean, I called myself the accidental CEO because there was no business plan for Redtail. Redtail was an idea that came out of this Our Business Aligned that I had done, and it was really an idea from an advisor saying maybe we should expose this to the rest of the world and investment financial services and see if it's interesting.
Yeah.
And it was. Well, actually, honestly, in the beginning, it wasn't. It sucked.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I went to my first conference. My first conference, if anybody's listening and remembers this, is MDRT, Million Dollar Roundtable.
Oh, I've been. Yeah, I've spoken.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I've never spoken. I've only attended as a booth in a dark corner and got told that I'm full of
Yeah.
You know, sorry, guys. But, you know, told that this is crap, garbage. And it was horrible. Like, it was a hard run in the beginning. And it took a couple of years of struggles to get it up and running. But that's why there was no business plan. It's just like, let's just try this. Let's try that. Let's try this. It was cool.
So I remember it would have been about 13 or 14 years ago now when I did my first ever pitch to an organization that's still very large and very active that I won't name in our space. And I came to them and I pitched them sort of behavioral economics consulting. And they literally said, this isn't a thing. Like, you know, they're like, this isn't a thing. Behavioral economics, like, what is this? Client psychology, who cares?
We don't get this.
I mean, it's just nothing. So, like, fascinating.
I remember sitting on panels when I finally started doing panels, sitting next to my competitors, and no real knock on them. I actually have friends with both of the competitors, and they said, you're a total fad. You're never going to, this will never make it because it's web-based.
Yeah.
Right? At the time, we were the only web-based solution, period.
Ah.
No one's going to trust your the data with you on the cloud.
Yeah.
We didn't call it the cloud at the time, just the internet.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I look back on that and it's like, I think that gave me some fuel to prove them wrong.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the second step, which is the refusal of the call. So this is when our hero becomes overwhelmed. It's too much. It's too grand. It's too scary. Clearly, you didn't refuse the call, but I have tons of friends who want to do what you did, right? Start a business, solve a problem, have a great exit. These wannabe entrepreneurs, though, are often scared for whatever reason, safety, security. What needs to be in place for an entrepreneur before taking the leap? And who should or shouldn't go into business for themselves? How should people think about whether to accept or to refuse the call?
Yeah, I think that's a complex question with a lot of different facets to answer there. Who shouldn't have called? I mean, when you're an entrepreneur, you got to understand a couple of things. One, you forget counting hours. There's no such thing.
Yeah.
There are 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and you will work every single one of them. Somewhere along the lines, you'll find sleep and family time and everything else. So you got to be prepared mentally and emotionally for that. It's a tough challenge, no matter how you look at it. You really need to understand the business you're getting into. That helps a lot. Or at least have a really good support team that can guide you down that path, that business path, and give you advice along the way. So hopefully you have a little bit of a network of people. You know, I know I talked to a number of different entrepreneurs who are starting up right now because that's exactly what we're trying to do is give them some encouragement, give them some advice and some support on their journey. Family support's gonna be critical. If I didn't have that, never would have got there. You know, I think I was newly married when Redtail started, 1 year in. and she had no idea that this was how life was going to end up being. And luckily, I had the amazing support of her to support me through this challenge. And because it took a massive amount of commitment, I feel like that's where most people fail, is that commitment of time. The second one is sometimes people just are looking for money to get it going. It's like, how about blood, sweat, and tears, people? Like, we used to pinch pennies to be able to be scrappy and get another server to help our clients. You know, learning how to be self-resilient with their finances or with hiring or any of that type of stuff. People go, no, we're going to hire 20 people and we'll have the business ready to go. You don't put the engine in the car first, people.
Yeah.
You know, we have to do some basics first. Let's work on a design. Let's get the wheels on this thing. Let's move. Is it build a skateboard and then advance up to the car. I think people sometimes take on too much too fast versus just getting into the weeds, do everything. You're going to wear every hat.
Yeah.
All the same stories, right?
I think a lot of times when people say they want to start a business, what they mean is they want to sell a business, right? They want to, you know, it means they don't want a boss or they want to be wealthy. And, you know, neither of those things are really at play when you start a business. Like, I mean, forget a boss. You're your boss, and you're the worst boss you've ever had because you're working 24/7, 365. And then, yeah, I mean, how long did you run Red Tail? I mean, how long was Red Tail in existence before you had your exit? 20-something?
Almost 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, I never had a plan for an exit.
Sure.
I think many people have interviewed me over that over the years and said, when are you going to sell? I'm like, never. I don't have no interest.
Yeah.
And I didn't until I was the last shareholder standing. You know, anybody else wanted to retire, which is good for them, you know. I was the youngest of the crew of Red Tail's shareholders. Mm-hmm. And as everybody wanted to retire out, I've realized I was on an island.
Mm-hmm.
And that was honestly one of the biggest motivators for me shopping Red Tail out. But I did not really shop it. I knew people I wanted to talk to, and I did. And it was very quick.
Yeah.
But what people don't realize is that as an entrepreneur, you know, that's one of the things, if I go back 10 years and someone wanted to buy the company, which they did every day, I feel like, they would want to buy the company. I'm like, I'm not emotionally ready for that.
Mm-hmm.
Because an entrepreneur, when you start something, it's your baby.
Yeah.
And with your baby, you're never going to just give it up. You're going to keep fighting for it. You're going to keep trying to do more and more and more. And if you're not emotionally ready to give it up, because people will change it the moment you sell it, it's not yours anymore.
Yeah.
That it can be hard on some people. I was fortunate that I had gone over that. I spent 6 months before I even told anybody I was interested in selling Red Tail. And I had made a list of kind of like, here's my non-negotiables. Here's what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in a good position at the time.
Yeah. So the next phase there, one of the next phases in Campbell's journey, we won't hit all of them today for time, but this is meeting the mentor, right? So this is where you meet the sage or the wizard or the Obi-Wan Kenobi who sort of guides you through, trains you. You've already mentioned in this podcast the need for good guidance, the need for good mentors. Who were some of the mentors you found away, and how did you seek them out, and what role did they fill? Were they more supportive? Were they teachers? Did they give you a kick in the pants and then kind of redirect you? How did you think about surrounding yourself with the right kind of voices?
So that's interesting, because I was, in the beginning, I didn't have that many voices. It was a small, small group. I'll give a shout out to Bob Curtis and Tony Leal, Money Guy Pro, ex-Money Guy Pro. They were really pivotal to me kind of understanding the business and feeling like anybody can do this. Like, you know, they started that company, the two of them, and built it to great heights, obviously a big exit and everything. But I've known them for 20 years plus, and they were just huge supporters. They're like, you can do this. Go, go, go. You know, we're so envious that you get to do this with us. You know, it's the same. They were the same exact business model. You know, a couple of partners working together, building software for the industry, and they're building software. And I was trying to really find people who are building that. So, you know, when I built Red Tail, you know, most people know that I coded a lot of it, especially early days. I wrote most of the code. I was building it without so much of the mindset of like one group of advisors, but rather the whole industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm looking for peers in the software side. Like, how can you help me on the SaaS model?
Mm-hmm.
How that works. The guys up at Advisor Websites, Bart and Jason helped me out quite a bit. Spencer Siegel over at Actify. I'm giving some good shout outs here.
Mm-hmm.
These people helped me out a lot and still do today as sounding boards. And I love it. And, you know, one of the great things about this industry has been amazing is how open it's been for me. Mm-hmm. You know, people let me in, and when I was scrappy young, fighting this at 20, I think I was 23 when I started Red Tail, and scrappy and giving me access that I didn't have because they're just good people, and they're like, we like working with good people.
Yeah.
And that was awesome.
Yeah. So I've heard it positioned that there are really two types of mentors, and one is sort of almost an uncritical raving fan. A few huge fanboy or fangirl of yours who just admires your work and has enough power and position and status to kind of open doors for you. The other would be someone who calls you on your nonsense and helps clarify your thinking and helps call you on the carpet when you're perhaps not doing what you ought to be doing or headed in a bad direction. Do you feel like you had both types of mentors? I mean, do you feel like you had people who could give you that tough love as well as people who could open doors for you?
I would say I had more of the tough love side of things than I had the door opening policy. Because I was not an advisor coming into this running the business, I'm literally just a tech nerd who was an IT grunt who started this.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know anybody, you know. I'd go to conferences and try and make introductions. I like to think of myself fairly social, so I'd get out there and just say hi to everybody and start talking. But what's interesting is I paired up with a lot of other product companies out there. you know, laser apps of the world and so forth. And they would help open some doors up and introduce us to people. But I never really had, as like what you think of today, like, here, let me show you this opportunity with this XYZ BD or something like that, or a big RIA group. Mm-hmm. No one really did that. It was really grassroots the whole way through.
How, I think for the average person, that's hard, right? Like, we want people who stroke our ego. And I think it's maybe doubly hard for entrepreneurs who are already like laying it all on the line. You know, I see this all the time with friends who have started their own businesses. It's just they're very protective, right? They're very protective. And while that's understandable, I also think it's dangerous. How did you get the courage or the guts to surround yourself with people who would call you on your nonsense?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give a great shout out to actually my old chief of staff in EA, Melanie Figler. She probably listened to this. And, you know, I had a right-hand person inside that would be straight up honest with me 24/7 with both ways. And that's what I expected from her, you know, and that's what she expected from me. It was here's what you said, here's how it was responded, how people responded to you once you were talking about, or how about things like, don't forget your words have a lot of meaning because of your position. I mean, these are things that people have to tell you as an entrepreneur, because as an entrepreneur, you came in just almost like an employee, I mean, attitude, right? You're like, hey, I'm just building this, mine, that's cool. But everybody you're hiring underneath you is coming up and saying, anything you say, I'm doing, I'm jumping. But you don't really think of that as an entrepreneur standpoint at first. It takes somebody else to call that out so that you're aware. I will tell you, all my executive team at Redtail knew this by heart, which was whenever we'd have any type of meeting, whether it was a one-on-one and group setting, it didn't really matter. It was, you have to be transparently honest across the board, especially with me, because a lot of times as the entrepreneur or the CEO, things are filtered heavily before they reach you. And I was really worried about that, because then I could end up in a bubble and have a company where I'm in the bubble, and even though it's mine, I need to be on the ground. I need to know exactly what's going on. And I would even tell people all the time, don't let me get surprised. Your job is, you hear something, is don't let me be surprised. Just shoot me a text, whatever, and keep me in the loop. I was so nervous about that. And that's where the teamwork, my staff was really, my friends and family around me to really support me.
Yeah.
I'm really lucky they're all still here too, at Orion. So,
you know, it's, I think there's so many organizations who give lip service to the very thing you just talked about, like, keep me under the bubble, be transparent, bring your truth to the meeting. And I think there's so few people who actually want to live that life. Like, they ask for it, and then when they get it, they punish people for it. So I think it's important to ask for it, because no one's assuming that you want that. They assume you want to be coddled and babied or whatever. Yeah. But then I think when you ask for it, you can't cut people's heads off for giving it to you, right? You got it.
Nope.
You got to thank them for tough feedback and go on. So the next part of the journey is the ordeal. And this is the point of greatest conflict that eventually goes on to mold and shape the character of the hero and be part of his or her arc. So at what point in the Redtail journey were you the most scared? What was like the peak frustration or the peak fear for you with Redtail? And how did this ordeal shape and mold you in the business?
I don't think we have enough time to cover all those times. I mean, as an entrepreneur, you're never going to have a day that doesn't scare you. You wake up, you don't know what's going on in the world. And that's the hard thing for, I think, a lot of people who are non-entrepreneurs understand, is that you wake up, this is your livelihood. This is your retirement plan, your future. You know, who knows what's going on? Every day is another challenge. But to get more pointed, I mean, well, famously, we're known for having that one data incident that we had back in 2018. When I found out about that, I would say that was the scariest moment. Like, you thought everything, the sky was falling. And it was, because you didn't have all the details. You didn't have all the facts. In the grand scheme of things, when you look back on it, it was honestly pretty minor. I mean, we took care of the clients the best we 100% could, you know. Did everything we could to bend over backwards because we believe in that raving fan mantra. We're going to do everything possible. We'll spend countless amounts of dollars to make it right by everybody because we screwed up. And it was a blind side that I didn't expect. And this happened, I forget what day of the week it was. It's probably like a Wednesday, just before Memorial Day. And where I was really proud though with this was I had a company, a culture that when I let a couple devs know and a couple of senior management know what was going on, in maybe an hour, maybe two, I had almost the entire company at night looking at code, reviewing everything, double checking and triple checking everything until we were 100% perfect. I didn't have to beg and plead for them to come in. They came in willingly to solve the problem. That told me that the company was in good hands. Like I knew I had a good team. And the real truth of it is, you know, that sent me into, I got ended up with anxiety after that, panic attack. I had a panic attack here and I never had one in my life. I think it's probably a rite of passage for an entrepreneur to have at least one panic attack. But that sucked. And it was tough, you know, and then you had to do interviews about this and do write-ups and all this other work and rebuild trust with your community and your tribe. And that took a lot. So
yeah,
that was the hardest.
How did you operate differently coming out of that 2018 event?
I don't think there was really a change per se the next day. It was more of like, oh, that eye-opening awareness. What you're dealing with is serious stuff. We have a lot of data, a lot of sensitive data we have to take care of. And we always did. This was a blind side that we'd never caught. And I changed what we do. We put in new procedures, new policies, triple checked everything and got it into a better spot. I learned from it. Mm-hmm. I think that was, we learned to be aware of those little possible edge cases that might exist and what the impact of that could be. For us, it was pretty significant. So it was luckily not company ending, but this has ended many companies this way. And I knew that was an issue. So I just bulked up on what I had to do. We doubled down more than that on cybersecurity.
Yeah.
Policies, procedures, training. I mean, just everything. It was just like, okay, this could happen. You always say, this could happen. Everybody else will have this. It never happened to us.
Mm-hmm. Man,
that happened to me. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So the ninth step in Joseph Campbell's monomyth hero's journey is the reward, where the hero gets his or her reward. And without getting too specific, obviously selling a company you've built over such a long period of time is a life-changing event for you. I mean, it changes your financial reality, right? What has been the impact of your newfound financial abundance, and how are you thinking through it to ensure that you enjoy the best parts of that windfall while avoiding the worst parts?
So that's a great question. I grew up with no means really. I mean, single mom raised me and a single kid and, always stretching a dollar out to make it work and everything. I'm used to that, right? I'm used to Walmart and all those type of things. So none of that's changing though. Like, we had the windfall, sure, but nothing's really changed, I don't think, from my perspective. Like, we didn't start doing anything big and crazy. However, we did make a bucket list as a family and we are going to accomplish all that. And that's really cool to have the freedom to be able to go do that. What's interesting though is, when I sold the company, I sold it for a partnership. I sold it to work with somebody else and keep going. I just love what I do every day. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like I'm not done. So like the windfall is fantastic. You know what's cool is it removed my risk. Mm. So I've leveraged my risk out now and I don't have to wake up in the morning going, oh my God, if something happens, which it won't, but if something were to happen, that's what's in the back of your head.
Yeah.
And I don't really stress about that anymore. That's kind of cool, which it changes your perspective of how you work now every day.
Yeah.
That's, I think, what most entrepreneurs, that's what I was told. I'm just now starting after like 7 months, starting to feel that for myself, which is I can take more risk. I can be more strategic and have bigger, loftier goals and work on them without the fear of a failure of some sort.
Like, yeah.
It's hard to describe. It's like there wasn't going to be a failure, but in the back of your head, right, that's always kind of rattling back there in your noggin. And you're kind of like, okay, well, if I do this, what's the outcome of this and stuff? I feel like I can be bolder.
I
like that.
I've heard it said that most financial planning conversations really boil down to, am I going to be okay?
Yeah.
And so after an exit like this, you're going to be okay.
But somebody had to tell me that thing.
Yeah.
Like my financial advisor team, they actually had to sit there at like our second meeting and say, hey, Brian, we just want to make it crystal clear to you. No matter what happens, you're good, man. Like, yeah, you're going to be okay. Like, your family, and really more importantly, my family is going to be okay. Because I think that's really what we care about is our family and our kids. Are they going to be good? That's, I mean, your business was your retirement plan.
Yeah.
Too, right? But every financial planning, I think, is the same way. That's what we all, I think everybody feels like, are we going to be okay? Can I retire? Can I just live a life? Like, yeah. Or am I going to be like homeless on the corner, And it's like being told you're not, it never really sunk in.
Yeah.
For a while.
Well, I think it's a powerful reminder because I remember you came to my house to went to a football game shortly after you sold the business. And I remember you telling us that how powerful a thing it was for your advisor to say to you, like, look, you're good. Like, you're good. Your family's good. And I think most people that would look at, you know, look at your exit would go, yeah, like, he's good, right? But still, you needed someone to tell you that. And I think we can't overemphasize that sort of as an industry. So I got to know, what are a couple of the cooler things on the bucket list? I need to know about one.
Oh, some of the bucket list things? Yeah. Okay, we just did one. We just did Bora Bora, which was phenomenal. Okay. Highly recommend. That was number one on the bucket list. I still want to build my own lazy river in the backyard. This one I know is absurd. It's been on my list. Anybody who knows Lee well,
absurd. Oh, cool.
Absolutely cool. And it's even supposed to be called It's a Small World of Beers. I'm like, because, you know, yeah, I have a pool, but you just kind of bounce around on a raft.
Yeah.
I want to, like, have some...
You want some?
You know, I want It's a yeah. Small World. You know? I need some action going on here. Like, let's go float around my backyard.
Will there be little animatronic folks serving you beer?
That would be so cool. I did have an idea for taps on the corners, like, okay. Where you can just kind of, and maybe somebody suggested an automatic sunscreen sprayer. I don't know how feasible that is, but yeah. if you're going to have dreams, you know, have goals and objectives. Other ones, I mean, I think really for our family, it's going to be a lot of travel.
Yeah.
We decided the budget, when you use a financial plan, you put your budgets in. Mm-hmm. We spent an absurd amount of money on travel budget. Because we want to see the world.
Yeah.
And that's the one thing I haven't been able to do for 20 years. I've seen the U.S. I know the U.S. really well after doing 300 days on the road every year.
Yeah.
I'm used to it. But I'm ready to go see and explore.
Yeah.
And I have some amazing kids I got to take out there and see the world too. So. Yeah.
Perfect. So the final step in the hero's journey is return to the ordinary world. And after 2 decades of building a high-growth startup, you're now a leader in a much larger organization. What leadership lessons are you bringing to Orion, and how can you keep the entrepreneurial drive that took you to such great heights alive in a much larger organization like this?
Yeah, you know, because I went from a 130-person company to being in charge of about 900 on my side of the org, which is crazy to think about that. That was a shocker at first. But then you realize, okay, this is just process. This is just designing culture to fit. And for me, culture and community was just so big. And that's one I spent all my time on, especially this first year, like really trying to build bonds. I need to know the people I'm working with, and who they need to know who I am and what I can bring to the table. I think that's one of the things that maybe in the next few months, even my team will be more and more surprised by, is what I can bring to them. After having the Redtail history, right, and all the experience there, I think if I can get that kind of dialed in pretty well and really just worry on the people side of things, I think we can do great, amazing work here at Orion. The culture blending is probably the toughest challenge. You know, Orion did buy 7 companies, 2 years. The second to last one. Townsquare was the last one. And putting those all together is now my job, partially, from the technology standpoint, right? We have all these technology stacks, all these different things, and I got to bring harmony to it all. Mm-hmm. And it's an awesome challenge. So I think I'm up to it. And, you know, I think keeping some humility and asking a million questions, and I'm so sorry to my team who I ask bajillions of questions to all the time, or I'm like, oh, how was this again? You know, I am learning, and luckily I'm a creature of habit and learning and stuff. I love doing that. And so I'm just deep diving.
Yeah.
And, I just can't wait to meet everybody, and it's going to be cool. We're here at Ascent doing this. We have 200 employees here under my watch, so I can't wait to see how many as I can.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, one of the challenges, I mean, I remember when Redtail was 25 people and what the culture was like there.
Yeah.
And I know I can't recreate that with 1,000, but how close can I get to that? You know?
Yeah.
Can I bring that level of family cohesiveness to a company? To make it feel like that. You feel like you're all part of something bigger. And I think that's when people will succeed and do an amazing work. You know, we're going to bring the Raving Fan mantra into Orion as well, which means a lot of things. And Raving Fans for us and for me always meant do anything by the customer. Do right by the customer. You know, bend over backwards. They need help with something, help them. But that also means also your team members. You know, we would always have a line of Redtail that we're starting to repurpose in here, which is, never leave a tailor behind. Mm-hmm. And it means a lot of things. It means emotionally supporting them. It means being there at the airport, walking out the terminal with them. It means a million different things.
Yeah.
But that idea, that community culture is what's so critical to build and make perfect. Or not perfect, but as good as I can.
Yeah. Well, I'm certainly glad to have you on my team now.
So I'm glad I'll be on Team Crosby. What are you talking about?
So last question for you. This is a little bit of a top one. You're a big Lego guy. Top three Lego sets of all time.
That is actually a tough one. I know. So, I mean, you don't even know this. I actually just built three more Lego sets. For people who are listening, I'm a big Lego guy. During the pandemic, I kind of got back into it. And it was a great outlet, especially as I mentioned earlier, I started having anxiety in 2018. That helped me trigger too, was a way to shut off my creative kind of side of the brain and just build. So to be really clear to everybody listening, I build sets. I don't just make up my own sets. So I just follow instructions. I have recently just done the Back to the Future time machine. Ooh, that was pretty cool. Nice. A little smaller than I thought.
So it's like a DeLorean?
It's a DeLorean. Okay. I would love Lego to make a big, massive version of it, like a high-end version. The Titanic was killer. It's actually probably one of the few sets I still have built, like after a year later. Uh-huh. It's 4 feet long, weighs like 30 pounds, and it looks like a ship model, like for real. The roller coasters are my favorite, and I absolutely love the city. I forget what they exactly call them, but the like boutique hotel and place stations that all will go together. I love those. I just got the Jazz Club one, and I did just build the Eiffel Tower last week. That's 5 feet tall. Not the most recommended set. It's impressive size-wise, but it's a little bland, a little gray.
That's a little gray.
Like I did the Imperial Star Destroyer, and that thing was huge, but it's all gray.
Yeah.
The Millennium Falcon's cool, too.
Yeah.
Should probably build that again.
Every time I take my kids to the Lego store, I probably go once a month, right, to the Lego store. I got a couple of Lego crazy kids. The Hedwig the Owl from Harry Potter is so cool looking. And I haven't bit the bullet on a $300 Lego Owl yet. It looks so cool. I'm not even a big Lego guy. And every time I go, I just want to build.
Oh, I'm lucky. I have the office in Sacramento still that we have the Red Tail Orion officer in SAC. And I just keep dropping them off in there like randomly on a weekend. I'm like, because where are you going to put them all? I'm like, they'll put them in the office. And people see someone new.
Got
Legos everywhere.
Beautiful. Brian, if people want to learn more about what you're up to at Orion, where can they find out more?
You can find me out on Twitter, limited LinkedIn. Just email me at brian@orion. How'd I get that cool email address? Brian@orion. How was that available?
Brian@orion, that's great.
I know. But you can find me on all major social media networks or any conference probably for the next year.
That's right.
I'll probably be at them.
Well, thank you for sharing your entrepreneurial journey with us and good luck on the journey ahead.
Thanks, Daniel.
All right, man.
Thanks for tuning in to Standard Deviations. If you can't wait till next week for more behavioral finance insights, visit www.orion.com. All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion and its affiliates, subsidiaries, and employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.